dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Today we're going to continue our series, Big Money, Bad Science, from a forum on biotechnology recorded last month in Vancouver, Canada. In our first hour, we're going to hear a panel, Science and the Public Interest. This will focus on how the commercialization of science, the drive for patentable and therefore profitable areas of inquiry, are destroying the public interest underpinnings of scientific research. While the public is being sold biotechnology as a solution to societal ills such as hunger, disease, and pollution, the scientists in tonight's panel will explain how it is likely to exacerbate those problems. And what about pharmaceuticals? The biotech industry promises new miracle medicines that will save lives. In our second hour, we're going to take a look at biomedical research and the ethical questions it poses. Please, pay close attention to the second panel if you or a loved one is a diabetic who uses insulin. You will hear how bioengineered insulin is not the miracle drug that it is cracked up to be, but has been responsible for the sudden deaths of many people. And you'll also hear tonight how some proponents of biotech hope to realize a nightmarish vision of the future, a brave new world. We strongly encourage you to tape this program and distribute this information widely. If you're not able to tape off the air, you'll also be able to download this program at the Unwelcome Guests website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome.
Stealing and lying and gambling, and I take it my way, my shiny black vest. I treat horses good.
Okay, the panel that you're about to hear is a panel on science and the public interest, ethics, testing, labeling, the precautionary principle, and the role of science in society. I think it's very important that we realize that our problem is not scientists or science, but bad science. And we make a very clear distinction here, and we have brought here a lot of good scientists who have very strong opinions about some of the bad science that's being practiced at this time. And they're going to talk about why they've become concerned. We're going to begin with David Steele, who studied genetics and molecular biology and went to Cornell, where he did a postdoc where he actually built the first artificial mitochondrial gene. Now, some of you may be thinking, oh my God, what is that? Maybe he can explain. But the important thing is he refused to patent it, a very unusual kind of activity from a scientist these days. David is a longtime activist, and he's been involved in the struggle opposing genetically engineered foods as well as many other social causes. So without further ado, I give you David Steele.
Hi. I'm going to mainly be talking about genetically engineered foods here and some background about how you can understand what they are and why they're dangerous, in my opinion. Before I get started, though, I'd like to tell you a little bit about a friend of mine who is doing this kind of work, and talk a little bit about motives, so you don't think that all scientists who are doing this are evil, but I believe they're all misguided who do this, but they're not all with bad motivations. I have a friend who's actually in Austria who is trying to use genetic engineering to make the food supply safer. That's his goal. He doesn't want to make money from it. He wants to make a safer food supply, especially for people in the third world like Iran and other countries. I believe his approach is mistaken, But I can see where he's coming from, at least. My friend's trying to make yeast, trying to make wheat. I'm a yeast geneticist, that's my problem. My friend is trying to make wheat that is resistant to a fungus that contaminates a great deal of wheat called Fusarium. Fusarium is a toxic fungus that affects wheat all over the world. It's a really serious problem in much of the third world. In Iran, for example, many years, 70% of their wheat supply is contaminated with Fusarium. And that's really a very big problem. Fusarium is responsible for a lot of throat cancers, a lot of cervical cancers. It's really a serious medical problem for those people. And it's a problem here as well. About 5% of Canadian wheat has Fusarium contamination, and there are standards which are probably a little too high for Fusarium content in wheat in our country. So what he's trying to do is engineer genes such that they will allow the wheat to grow and not be infected by the fungus. That said, I think his goal is laudable. His approach, however, is very dangerous, and I'm going to explain why I think his approach is very dangerous and should not be taken now. In my opinion, GE crops should never have ever have been let out of the laboratory, not yet, and perhaps very few of them in the future might be acceptable, but generally the risks are far too high. Until each and every GE strain is very carefully evaluated and tested in very controlled experiments, there should be none in the fields whatsoever, in my opinion, and you're about to hear why. So first of all, what is a GE crop, in case you don't know? I'm going to start with just explaining how plants were traditionally produced. So normally, if you had, say, two different kinds of corn, one that was particularly sweet, you liked the flavor, another one that would grow well in very dry environments, but didn't taste so good, you would try and create one that could grow well in the dry environments and be sweet by crossing them. You simply cross the sweet corn to the drought-resistant corn. If you keep crossing long enough, eventually you get a fairly sweet corn that'll grow in the dry environment, and you're fairly happy, and that's your new corn variety. It's often a very, very slow process, and it works only within related species, but it has been working for the last 10,000 years, and it's generated tens of thousands of different kinds of corn or beans or wheat or whatever you want to name. Huge varieties. GE plants are completely different. The approach is absolutely different. What one does is use recombinant DNA technology instead. And that means you can take a gene from anything, a mouse, a frog, a goat, you name it, and put it into whatever other organism you want to put it into. So, for example, there are antifreeze proteins from fish being put into tomatoes now by genetic engineering approaches. It's a very fast technique very frequently, and it can yield really novel results. And those novelties are mostly unknown. But it also can yield extremely dangerous, at least it's potentially extremely dangerous for reasons I'll explain. And in order to start to understand the dangers, you need to know something about how genes are put into plants. Basically, what one does is clone your favorite gene, whatever it is, and for plant expression, you'll put it under a promoter to express it in the cells you want to express it in. Most often, it's going to be something like the cauliflower mosaic virus promoter there, which is a promoter for a specific gene, which is turned on very powerfully in pretty much every cell. Your gene would then be under that control. You also have on that plasmid means of following the plasmid to make sure you have it where you want it to be. And those means are antibiotic resistances. The bacterial antibiotic resistance, in order to be able to make the DNA to propagate it in bacteria, that would be something like ampicillin or tetracycline, and an antibiotic that you normally would take medically as well. And for the plants, you'll generally have an antibiotic resistance. For an antibiotic, you couldn't actually use medically because it would probably kill you as well. There are a number of reasons to worry about that design. First is the presence of that viral promoter. That viral promoter, my PhD was actually in genetic recombination, by the way, and that viral promoter could very well combine with wild-type virus in the field. Now, it would have to be unusual form of recombination of the promoter there, and illegitimate recombination is called further downstream in order to get your favorite gene into a virus, but rare events can happen. Matter of fact, if you have billions and billions of plants out there, rare events won't seem so rare. And if that occurs, whatever your gene is there is now in some plant virus, and who knows what effect that might have. And it depends what your gene is, how it influences things, who knows. The risk's unclear, but certainly not a risk I'm willing to take. The other problem with the plasmid design is not so much the plant antibiotic resistance gene, but the bacterial antibiotic resistance gene. There have been studies in bees, for example, that have shown that these antibiotic resistances can be taken up by the bacteria in the gut. And our guts are full of bacteria as well. And if they do take up that DNA, they're instantly resistant to the antibiotic. And so what that does is increase the probability of antibiotic resistance increasing in our world. We already have very serious problems with antibiotic resistance, largely because of our agricultural use of antibiotics as it is. We don't need to be adding more threats to our arsenal against human infectious diseases. Okay, so once you have this thing, how do you get it into a cell? There's a couple of ways. I was going to tell you about a gene gun because it seems most technically interesting, I guess. What one does is simply paint that plasma DNA, but basically drop it on top of some metal particles, and you shoot the particles into plant cells. The plant cells get the DNA because they've been fired at, and this DNA has been forced into them by these little bullets that are coated with them. The plant cells are then allowed to grow up into full-blown plants. And you then have something you can produce seed from and see how your gene is expressed. What kind of things have been made this way? So far, there are things like Roundup Ready soybeans, Roundup Ready canola. There's corn and cotton that are resistant, that carry a toxin called BT toxin, which is a bacterial toxin. There are frost-resistant tomatoes. In the pipeline, there are plants that will be producing drugs, drug manufacturing plants, and drug manufacturing animals like goats that produce a drug in their milk. And there is even talk about making vaccines with these plants, and it goes on and on from there. And why worry about all this stuff? Seems, well, pretty high tech. Wow, that's pretty great. First worry is human health. I think there's probably not too many direct effects you have to worry about here. Most often, these things are not going to directly harm your health. It's not clear that they won't, and I'm not saying we should, I'm saying on that basis alone, we don't want them around. But most often, direct health effects are relatively not the main worry. Occasionally, there'll be allergenic proteins, so there will certainly be occasional allergic problems. And like I said, the antibiotic resistance could be something of a direct threat, especially if in your own gut you transfer the antibiotic resistance. But for the most part, that's not the biggest worry. It's enough of a worry, in my opinion, to stop the whole thing, but that's not the biggest worry at all. There are much worse. There are ecological effects which are very frightening. One, for example, is I talked about the BT toxin. BT toxin is normally produced in an inactive form in a bacterium, Bacillus thuringiensis, and it has to be activated in an alkaline gut of an insect. The toxin is normally degraded by UV light, the sunlight, and it has a very short half-life when dropped on plants, and organic farmers use it a lot. They have a problem, they'll throw this bacterium on their plants and the toxin's available to kill off the insects. But the toxin doesn't stick around very long because the UV light from the sun, the bacteria doesn't live very long, it doesn't have a food source. The toxin's gone in a couple of days. In BT corn, for example, though, the whole thing's been turned around. The toxin's expressed in an active form, so it's active no matter what eats it, the toxin is active. The toxin is expressed in every single cell of the plant, so it's protected from UV by being internal to the plant, not on the surface. It can leach into the soil, and it has been shown to leach in the soil from some corn plants at least, and is extremely long-lived in the soil, so you now have toxin present in the soil at all times. And so what you have, you've gone from occasionally briefly present toxin to a constantly present active toxin. And what that means is insects are going to rapidly become resistant to this. The fact is that when something is constantly exposed to something that kills it, there's always a small portion of the population that's resistant. That portion of the population will take over. They'll survive, and they'll reproduce, and you'll end up with insects, huge numbers of insects, and only those insects surviving that are no longer harmed by BT toxin. So we'll soon have resistant insects in the environment. There's already some evidence this is happening in China. And the biggest problem from this will be that organic farmers are going to be hurt the most. They depend often on BT toxin, brief treatments of BT toxin to get rid of pests. Once you have a world full of insects that are not sensitive to BT toxin, organic farmers will be of no value to them to use the BT toxin. We'll have a lot more pest problems for people who aren't using the chemical companies' pesticides. And of course, people making who made BT toxin, of course, are these BT plants are generally chemical companies, in case you didn't know. Another problem that comes from using these things is the result of gene flow. Every plant makes pollen, you know that. And you can, pollen cross-pollinates left and right and indiscriminately with related plants. Genes can and do pass from plant to plant, as you well know. That's sex in plants. And they can and do pass from GE crops to wild-type crops, conventional crops, and into related weeds. Already in Alberta, canola resistant to three herbicides have been found in farmers' fields. That is a result of first one or a GE plant crossing with another one, and then that crossed plant, which now is resistant to two herbicides, crossing to yet another herbicide-resistant plant and getting super plants resistant to three different herbicides. So even for conventional farmers, this is a very serious problem. They have no way of getting rid of this canola as a new weed. It's just a weed that their herbicides will not get rid of, whatever they do. Some grains can also cross with related grasses, so that those aren't even crops. And also, when this occurs, of course, we'll create super weeds of those grasses, which will be expressing the herbicide resistance genes. And so they're into the wild, and they're not useful. So the point is that in a very short term, just a few years, we can expect to find these herbicide resistant GE crops are very little use to anyone, because there'll be all kinds of weeds that are resistant to all the herbicides as well, and these herbicides will be outdated. I didn't realize I was taking that. I've got a relief move here. Other things are threats to the food supply. I'm sorry. Whenever you limit the number of different varieties you plant, you increase the chances of having an ecological disaster. The Irish potato famine was such an example. A very limited number of different potato species were grown in Ireland, and a fungus came through and killed them in the 1840s, 1850s, and caused a huge famine, massive death, massive immigration. If one of our new super GE crops turns out to give farmers a huge advantage, it grows much faster, gives sweeter corn everyone likes, that might take over the vast majority of fields. If there is a disease that gets that specific corn, we could have a huge crop failure and actual starvation almost anywhere as a result use of too narrow a group of, I'm trying to go fast, I'm getting myself confused. But if some blight comes along, like I said, we could lose our food supply, or at least for one of our grains very rapidly, all because we've gone for far too narrow a group. There are economic concerns I wish I had time to get into very well. Basically, if these things aren't being made to the benefit of the general public, they're being made to make money for large multinationals, mostly chemical companies. Genes are being patented, plants are being patented. The chemical companies are trying to take over our food supply. They're buying up the seed companies so that they can put out their patented genes, their patented plants to the seed companies, and farmers will have little choice but to buy their crops. And their ultimate goal is to make us dependent on them for all of our food supply. I also want to make, if I can quickly get in, a little bit about vaccines. There are people talking about creating vaccines in plants now. That would be you ate a banana, you're vaccinated against polio, for example. And the big problem with that is, in order for a vaccine to work, from a food product, you have to produce an awful lot of whatever the antigen is, the protein you want to get your immune system to respond to, because it has to get to your stomach, get through your stomach, into your intestines, and get into your bloodstream. Okay, that's fine for the first one, so you get that in, you have this massive amount of polio antigen, whatever it is, it gets into your bloodstream, that's great, you're now vaccinated. What happens if cross-pollination has occurred, other bananas or tomatoes, whatever product they're being made, have taken up this gene as well, just because the wind has carried the pollen to them. And a few weeks later, you eat another banana, and it turns out it's also heavily laden with this antigen. You may find yourself dying, because you may find your immune system thinks it's being attacked by a massive infection of the polio that you just vaccinated yourself with. You may go into anaphylactic shock, your throat may close up, you choke to death, essentially, and you die. And that's a very big potential problem and danger that I wish I could have gotten more into, but I'm out of time.
Okay, our second speaker is Doreen Stabinski. Doreen is the science advisor to Greenpeace on its genetic engineering campaign, and she too has studied plant genetics at the University of California at Davis. And she was a professor of environmental studies at California State University in Sacramento, where her research focused on biotechnology and international environmental policy. She's an activist scholar who participated in the negotiations of the biosafety protocol, and she's currently working on conflicts over life patenting in the Convention on Biological Diversity and the World Trade Organization. Dory.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Sorry to say I can't see any of you because of these lights, but happy to be here with you anyway. Today I want to talk about the precautionary principle and genetically engineered organisms and tell you a little bit about what the precautionary principle is. The precautionary principle, it's an overarching principle to guide regulatory decision making about hazardous substances in the face of scientific uncertainty. In a nutshell. But I'm going to talk to you about the precautionary principle by contrasting it with the way we actually evaluate hazardous substances right now using a procedure that people call risk assessment. And I'm going to talk about the precautionary principle and genetically engineered organisms by telling you a little bit about risk assessment and toxic chemicals. Toxic chemicals being, we have a lot of experience of looking at risk assessment of toxic chemicals, and through our experience with that, there's a lot of lessons that we learn about how risk assessment's an inappropriate way to look at hazardous substances like toxic chemicals, and I'll make the argument also that the same criticisms apply to risk assessment and genetic engineering. And I'll finish up by talking about the precautionary principle as an alternative framework for looking at how we view risky substances, or in the case of genetic engineering, risky organisms. Now, risk assessment is based on the principle that you can measure the risk of putting a particular substance in the environment. You measure the amount of hazard. You categorize the hazard of that particular substance. Is it carcinogenic? At what level is it carcinogenic? And then you look at, you can measure exposure, how much of that substance is in the environment, and you do some fancy subjective mathematical calculations to come up with a very nice number, which then is the risk of that chemical in the environment. And when we do hazard assessment of toxic chemicals, we generally do it a single chemical at a time, and we look at particular what are called endpoints. Does this chemical cause cancer? What amount of this chemical causes cancer? What amount of this chemical causes teratogenicity, that is, birth defects causing, what amount of the chemical can cause a mutation in DNA. And it's this, there's a number of aspects of risk assessment that have been critiqued, a number of criticisms that have been put forward. I'm just going to mention three that I think are really important criticisms. One is this is the definition of endpoints. And so when we look at toxic chemicals, we evaluate their toxicity with respect to, well, do they kill you if you eat them? Do you drop dead immediately? And that would be acute toxicity. We also look at some of the chronic kinds of toxicities characteristic of chemicals. Do they cause cancer? Do they cause birth defects? Do they cause mutation? We've added a new one lately. Do they disrupt the hormonal system, the endocrine disruptors? But there's an awful lot of endpoints that we would think are significant that you can't measure, and because risk assessment really depends on the output of this very nice number at the end, if you can't measure things, they just don't become part of your assessment. So things like immune system impacts, so suppression of the immune system, well, you can't really measure that. And so that's not an endpoint that people look at in risk assessment. It's as if it's not one of the effects of the chemicals, but in fact it is. Reduced learning ability, reduced fertility, altered behavior, all kinds of sublethal impacts that can't be measured aren't. So risk assessment doesn't take them into consideration. A second criticism is that the test organisms are limited. And I've just given you a lot of examples with respect to toxicity to humans, and to measure toxicity to humans, we look at related mammals like guinea pigs and rats and mice. But in fact, we assess the risks on a whole range of other organisms, or we should, because in fact there's a whole lot of other organisms out there that are being exposed to toxic chemicals when they're released into the environment. But in fact, risk assessment, because you have to bring those animals into the laboratory and do the tests, risk assessment depends very much on testing chemicals on organisms that are easily culturable, ones that you can bring into the laboratory. It cannot necessarily look at all of the organisms that we might think are particularly significant in terms of they're the most highly susceptible or in terms of the fact that they're most important in the particular ecosystem that they live in. And so there's a lot of impacts on organisms that we can't test for because of that. And a final criticism, you know, risk assessment looks at single organisms and single chemicals. Well, we have a multitude of chemicals in the environment, many of which interact with each other. And if we look at an ecosystem is a whole set of interactions of organisms. And the work that's done in the laboratory is looking at suborganismal and organismal effects, right? Does it kill this particular organism? But you can't take those results then and extrapolate to the larger ecosystem, which are in fact the impacts that we really care about. I mean, we care about whether this one particular organism dies, but we also care about if this organism dies, what does that mean in terms of the health of the ecosystem? How intact is it? Risk assessment can't, because of the techniques available to it, can't look at long-term impacts, can't look at sublethal impacts, can't look at those impacts on the larger ecosystem. The complexity of ecosystems, you just can't take that into account when you're doing the single species testing in the laboratory. So that, you know, you end up with the things that you can measure with risk assessment are not necessarily those things that are relevant to the ecosystem, to human health, et cetera. Now, let me talk a little bit about risk assessment for genetically engineered crops. Some of the hazards of genetically engineered crops have been identified by Dave. Toxicity of the new protein, for instance. The plant is producing a new protein. Also, there are potentially changes in the plant that result from the process of genetic engineering. So there may be some other toxic substance that the plant now produces, or a substance that's now produced at a higher level in the plant that's now problematic. Gene flow. Other impacts on the ecosystem. So for instance, these BT crops that Dave talked about, it turns out that they exude that poison into the soil. And so one of the problems of genetically engineered crops in the environment could be the plants or the plant product affecting ecosystem processes, like processes in the soil. The soil, there's a lot of life that lives in the soil. Bacteria, fungi, insects, earthworms, et cetera, all of which are important for creating a healthy soil. And so if you damage the soil ecosystem, you damage the long-term ability of that soil to produce crops. Now, how are these hazards assessed in a risk assessment for genetically engineered crops? Well, for the toxins, only acute toxicity is measured. There's no other test done. And in fact, it's not even the genetically engineered plant that's tested. Generally, what's done is they take a bacterium, they produce the novel protein in the bacterium, they purify that, and they stuff it down the throats of mice. And it's a very unpleasant thing to read about, but they stuff an awful lot down a mouse's throat, and then they sit and wait for 14 days and see if the mouse drops dead. That's the only testing for toxicity that's done of genetically engineered plants. And as I said, it's not even the plant itself that's tested on the organism, but a purified protein. For soil ecosystem effects, they test an organism called Columbella, which I'm not familiar with. They test earthworms. The companies are not required to test for those organisms that are most ecologically relevant to the soil ecosystem. Impacts on bacteria, impacts on fungi of the proteins that come out of the plant and go into the soil. For gene flow that Dave talked about, the companies are not required to submit any quantitative data on how far pollen travels, on outcrossing rates, how likely is it for a plant to cross with another wild relative nearby. None of that's required. So that the real risks of genetic engineering, I would say, the long-term effects on human health, those sublethal chronic effects that aren't tested for, right, only acute toxicity is tested for, the long-term effects on biological diversity, none of those risks are addressed by traditional risk assessment. So I'd argue that risk assessment is inadequate, and it's inappropriate, and we should look to another way of assessing hazards of both genetically engineered crops and the toxic chemicals in our environment. And in fact, in the mid-80s, the federal government in Germany developed a principle called Vorsorgeprinzip, my attempt at German, or the principle of precautionary action, or as people call it, the precautionary principle. And I think there's four components that you can think about with respect to the precautionary principle. That is, if there's a threat which is uncertain, then some kind of action is mandatory. And I'll expand on this four different points to elaborate this. One, the precautionary principle really says that damage should be avoided in advance. It's a principle that prevention is better than curing. So prevent some threat from happening. A second point, appropriate scientific research is essential. The precautionary principle is not anti-science. It says that appropriate scientific research is necessary to inform decision-making and to identify emerging threats. A third point, action is essential, even in the face of uncertainty. And this is one of the places where, you know, we get the greatest reaction from on the part of people who want to stay with risk assessment, because in fact there's a lot of information that we don't have, and in fact there's a lot of information that it's very difficult to get. What are the impacts on the soil ecosystem of BT crops? That's a very long-term research effort. We don't have that information. We do have information that there's a threat there, and in fact the precautionary principle would mandate action in the face of that uncertainty. Risk assessment would say, we're not going to act until we actually have the information. And as people argue, not acting is in fact acting. It's in fact taking a regulatory action that says go ahead and assume this threat. Part of the precautionary principle also looks at, also reverses the onus of proof. That is, it's the responsibility of those people who are putting toxic chemicals or who are putting genetically engineered organisms into the environment to prove safety. It's not our responsibility to prove that they're unsafe, and that's in fact what people are trying to tell us at this point. You know, that you have no proof that they're not safe. Well, I mean, we can throw that back to them. They have no proof that this is safe, because in fact there's not a lot of scientific information out there that says that these things should be going into the environment. One final point about the precautionary principle, and that is it advocates technological developments that meet the requirement for a progressive reduction in our impact on the environment. This is sort of the flip side. If you're going to ban, if you're going to take action against very dangerous substances, that in fact you have to, you know, be promoting clean production technologies, be promoting the alternative that is, in fact, that reduces impact on the environment. Now, the implementation of the precautionary principle is not without precedent. The countries around the North Sea, in a set of conventions, the Oslo and Paris conventions, or OSPAR, have looked at a class of toxic chemicals that are called the organochlorines. They're chemicals that are based on carbon. That's the organo part, with chlorine attached to them. And they've looked at these chemicals and they've said they are toxic, they are persistent, they don't go away, and they have a tendency to bioaccumulate. That is, they dissolve in the fat cells of organisms, and they don't go away. And in fact, they accumulate within the body, and they also concentrate in magnitude as they go up the food chain. And these countries have said that this is a class of chemicals that is hazardous. We know they're hazardous. And in fact, in implementing the precautionary principle, we're going to phase out the use of these chemicals. So the whole countries all around the Northeast Atlantic, by the year 2020, have made a commitment to phase out all organochlorines. And in fact, then the flip side of that is to come up with clean production alternatives. How do you now live without chlorines, without organochlorines in production? I think that genetic engineering requires us to do the same sort of, to take the same sort of steps. There are known hazards associated with genetic engineering. There are unknowable hazards, right? There's a high degree of scientific uncertainty. I think that there's an intrinsic characteristic of genetically engineered organisms that is highly problematic in this regard, and that is they reproduce. So just as organochlorines are persistent in the environment, we can't get rid of them. This is a very problematic characteristic. I think our genetically engineered organisms also have a very problematic characteristic. We're not going to be able to get rid of them. They go out into the environment, they reproduce. There's more of them. There's not just the same amount, right? There's actually more once they go out and reproduce. And in fact, you know, this sort of fourth point that I made about having alternatives, I think that there are demonstrable alternatives to genetic engineering that reduce environmental impact. I mean, we know that there's organic and sustainable methods of producing food, and we don't need to go down the path of genetic engineering and releasing hazardous organisms into the environment. Which leads Greenpeace to its position, which is based on the principle of precaution. We should have no release into the environment of genetically engineered organisms. Our position is for a ban and no release into the human food supply. And in fact, I was really happy to see there's these great postcards outside, and maybe in your packet as well, which basically say the same thing. You can take the same position and you can send this little postcard to the government of Canada saying, I call upon the Canadian government to stop the release of GMOs in our environment and to demand that Canada acknowledge the precautionary principle by signing the Biosafety Protocol Agreement. So I'll leave you with that. Do your part. Send this to the Canadian government, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Doreen. Our last speaker is Warren Bell, and he's been a family physician for 24 years. He graduated from McGill University in 1974. And for two decades, he's been concerned about and involved in issues of social development and the environment, including the peace and anti-nuclear movement, global health and development, as well as looking at the whole question of globalization and the role of corporations and the drug companies in patenting. He's written and spoken in many settings, and he's participated in a number of projects. He is the past president of the Physicians for Global Survival and the current president of the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, which is an affiliate of the International Society of Doctors for the Environment. Dr. Bell.
Good afternoon. I'm here as a physician who is not necessarily overcome by the blandishments of industry with regard to genetically engineered products. I'd like to talk today about the underpinning, the holy grail that drives biotechnology and many sectors in industry. It certainly drives the pharmaceutical sector. And that is the patent itself. You'll look through the program, you'll see the word patent mentioned a number of times. What I'm going to talk about is the patent, the generic entity known as the patent. Because I think if you don't understand that, you're not going to understand why there's this incredible rush to assume that biotechnology is good, if you don't understand how patents give enormous power and material advantages. The first overhead is a little historical background. Patents began over 100 years ago. They began in Paris, the center of fashion, and you'll notice the second point there that it was written in French. The first global patenting agreement was written in French, the language of cosmetics and fashion and various other civilized attributes, so-called. It also began in the core time of the age of colonialism and exploitation of the world, and it's also important to recognize that that's the origin point of the patenting system globally. That was a time when racism, exploitation of the environment, and colonial activities were the norm. That's the time when a group of politicians and aristocrats in Europe sat down with some cartography tools and divided Africa up among them. You know, draw this line here, no, I'll take that, no, well, you can have this, we'll do that. That's the kind of world that patenting was globally extended through. The original name, the Convention for the Creation of an International Union for the Protection of Industrial Property, but who was there? Seven European nations and one or two of their big colonies like Brazil. Now, the original patent law was very modest. It only protected the things that it covered for 6 months. And it only protected a very few things, as you see up there. But in 1967, or by 1967, the global patent system had gone through a number of revisions. And you can see here what it covers now. 90 countries have signed. Not every country has to sign, but most countries tend to abide by it. Those who don't are a little more recalcitrant in following the principles of global patenting. But at the very bottom, maybe you could slide that up so people can see. I think it may be a little bit behind. Look what it covers now. Patents, utility models, industrial designs, trademarks, service marks, trade names, indication of source or appellations of origin, covering all manufactured or natural products, for example, wines, grain, tobacco leaf, fruit, cattle, minerals, mineral water, beer, flowers, and flour. I think there's something, I think air and water are still freely available to all of us, so in case you're worried, there are some things left out. But look also the language of this global agreement. Look at the languages that are used. They are the languages of the major colonizing nations still. The global patenting laws have never been formally translated into any language from any part of the world that is on the receiving end of the colonializing impulse. Can we go to the next overhead? I want to just outline what a patent is, because the word's bandied about quite a bit, but it's not always clear what we're talking about. A patent is a monopoly. Any of you have played Monopoly in your childhoods or your adulthoods, you know the word. A monopoly means you have exclusive rights. In this case, the rights are granted to you by society as a whole. They're granted to a person, but of course nowadays that's a corporation as easily as it is a person. And I've synthesized a number of definitions here. To sell or disperse a process or substance as he, now he is in quotation marks, that could be a man, a woman, a corporation, or any other kind of entity, as long as they want to do so within the limits of the patent law. Now, patent laws used to be 6 months when they started out. Now, in many parts of the world, they're 20 years. So you have 20 years license to sell or disperse whatever you've produced and had patented, unlimited, on the planet. Now, the advantage of this system, this is how it was originally developed, was to encourage people to be inventive. Here's this holy grail, this vast wad of dough awaiting you at the end of your patenting search. It encourages people to be novel in their solutions, seek novel solutions to the world's problems. But there are some disadvantages as well. The patent holder, whoever it is, has total control over the sale and distribution of the service or product. The patent holder also has all the benefits. It's an ultimate destabilizing, anti-egalitarian process. I get everything, and all the rest of you get nothing. That's how patents work. And that's why they're very attractive to industry. It also encourages something that's a little more subtle. It encourages a search for things that can be patented, for things that we would call products. Now, I want to go to the next overhead to show you that that actually results in a distortion of what we consider important. And we're so overwhelmed by patenting, we don't even most of the time recognize how the patenting process is distorting our thinking. First of all, patents encourage individual effort. They encourage singular, isolated, that's a misspelling, isolated processes. They tease out a process from a vast web of processes because that's the only thing you can patent. They encourage the development of synthetic molecules. The hormone progesterone is a wonderful thing. It exists in practically every mammal on the planet. But you can't patent it, so you make medroxyprogesterone, acetate, and then you can patent it and you can make a huge pile of boodle. Now, it turns out that progesterone's much better in that hormonal realm than medroxyprogesterone. It's a lot safer. But you can't patent it. So what's on the market today, sports fans? Medroxyprogesterone acetate, Provera. I won't ask for a show of hands of how many people are using it. But that's how the patent system worked. It diverts attention towards what can be synthesized and away from what's occurring in the world around us. It encourages an anthropocentric attitude towards the world. If you can make it, it's good. If it occurred by itself, and Mother Nature and the incredible processes of the natural world generated it, it's not interesting. It also generates increased expense. Have you ever tried to buy a tablet of medroxyprogesterone acetate when it first came out? You'd have to spend a lot of money. If you bought a tablet or a vial of cream of progesterone, it was very inexpensive. And that's the rule that applies to all patenting processes. Accutane, I happen to know some of these medical things. Accutane is used for acne. It happens to be a metabolite of vitamin A. To get enough vitamin A to treat acne in the same dosage level for a month costs about $10. To get enough Accutane for a month is going to cost you $95. And that's a common garden rule for how patents affect marketplace. It encourages a limitation of access to substances. I've got it, you can't have it, what's it worth to you to use my product? It also encourages secrecy. People go into their laboratories and their underground bunkers and they work wildly away at some potentially patentable solution because they don't want anybody else to know what they're doing, because if they get there first, all the money's gone. Finally, they also encourage valueless invention and increased technological complexity. There's no reason to use a simple natural solution when you can make a complex man-made solution to make a huge pile of dough. Patents also discourage certain things that are very much innate to our society and our communities and our lives. They discourage collective effort, people working together. They discourage complex processes and using complex web-like processes, holistic processes, because you can't patent them. Of course, their patents are completely inimical to ecosystems, because ecosystems are far too complicated. They discourage wide access to something, because if you own it and you have the patent, then you don't let anybody have it unless they fulfill your conditions for attaining it. They discourage transparency, the opposite of secrecy. They discourage cost reduction because the increased expenses of acquiring patented products. They also discourage community-based values. Something that's important to all of us may not be something that leads to a patentable product. Fitness. You can't patent fitness. You can't patent breast milk. Every baby in the world before the invention of formula was nourished with breast milk, but you can't patent it, so it's not interesting to industry. And we have been so swayed by product thinking, product-based thinking, that for many people in this room, at one time or another, you might have thought that breastfeeding wasn't really that important. Formula was maybe better. I hope you've all changed your minds now. Now, moving on to the next overhead, I'm just going to underline the three critical points that I think patenting and the process of intellectual property rights, which is the broad term under which patents fall, they distort our thinking, all of our thinking. If we're not alert to it, they're going to distort our thinking constantly. They encourage the solution, the search for patentable products. If you can't patent it, then the public relations industry will never be promoting it to you, because no industrial sector will be interested in it. They take man-made processes, the second point, and put them front and center. You're not interested, if you're searching for patents, you're not interested in what the natural world has to offer, except if you can fiddle with it, change it, and make it yours, and then you can patent it. Finally, they downgrade all the natural occurring community-based biological process as a corollary to that to second class in our minds. There would never have been a triumph of formula over breast milk without intellectual property rights and patents. Finally, I want to close with a few opinions about patents, because some people will try to tell you that the marketplace demands patents. Well, in the scientific community, of course, that's nonsense. The first quote is from an article in the Scientific American saying, "Any form of protection for intellectual property limits the diffusion of research results. It is more effective in generating the development of products than in generating scientific advances." The second quote is from a Canadian anesthetist, Alan Klass from Manitoba, saying the same idea. It's all a commercial thing. It's nothing to do with science. So if anyone says to you, patents drive science, understand that that's not what scientists think, except scientists who want to make a lot of money. Finally, two free market economists, one a very intense, rabid marketeer, Murray Rothbard, who died recently, rabid, but he was also a very fine intellect. But he was a libertarian. He believed totally in the marketplace ruling everything. But he said, on the free market, there would be no such thing as patents. He objected to their collusive nature. And good old Milton Friedman didn't like patents either. He said, patents are a way of maintaining private collusive arrangements that would otherwise collapse. So the archetypical market-oriented economists don't like patents. And if they don't like patents, no one who is selling you anything can tell you that they have a really valued and useful role in terms of science. They certainly don't have a very valid and useful role anymore, the way they are now constituted, in terms of society. Thank you.
You've been listening to a panel on science and the public interest that was part of the Big Money Bad Science Forum on Biotechnology that took place last month in Vancouver, Canada. In our second hour, we'll look at the medical and ethical issues involved with bioengineered medicines and gene therapies. This is on Welcome Guests.
Those polar bears now, who really cares now? They're breeding gender-bending babies who won't be breeding none, 'cause PCBs, yeah, are in the seas, yeah. We like to think that there's a little piece of us in everyone, 'cause we're Monsanto. That's right, Monsanto. We're turning Satan into Santa by giving kiddies cancer coming through now. We're changing you now. The Mother Nature Terminators of food and health and hope. That DDT man, don't let on me, man. 'Cause we had all these creepy crawlies falling on the food we grew was a revolution. It's just a shame that what we sprayed on made the turnips toxic too. Let me remind you about Indochina. Them commie dominoes were falling, so they sprayed them into hell. Get peasant farmers, orange pajamas. We made their jungle cover wither, then we withered them as well. 'Cause we're Monsanto, that's right, Monsanto. We're turning Satan into Santa by giving kiddies cancer. Coming through now, we're changing you now. Mother Nature Terminators of food and health and hope. It's not our fault, there's chemical warfare.
That was Food and Health and Hope by Seize the Day, a band from the UK, a country whose people have vehemently rejected biotech foods. Recently, Monsanto began an international campaign to clean up its tarnished image. John Vidal reported on the reaction in the December 1st issue of the London Guardian. Contrite GM firm pledges to turn over a new leaf. 5 years ago, Monsanto planned to flood the world with GM crops and reap the profits. 3 years ago, it received a bloody nose in Europe and had to apologize to the British for misunderstanding their hostility. Now, in a feast of humble pie, the world's leading biotech company has admitted to the world that it has been arrogant, blind, and insensitive, and has formally pledged to be, quote, honorable, ethical, and open in all its future actions. The new Monsanto, said the corporation's president and chief executive, Hendrik Verfaeli, is now outwardly very different to the one which promised to be a part of the solution to world hunger and environmental problems only 5 years ago. Instead of trumpeting faith, hope, and prosperity, the genetically modified line is now that biotechnology is a way to improve human health and that Monsanto is contrite, listening, and leading world business into an ethical age. Even our friends told us we could be arrogant and insensitive, said Mr. Verfaeli of the company, which has merged with the pharmaceutical giants Pharmacia and Upjohn. We were blinded by our enthusiasm, he told a Washington audience this week. we miss the fact that this technology raises major issues for people, of ethics, of choice, of trust, even of democracy and globalization. When we tried to explain the benefits, the science, and the safety, we did not understand that our tone, our very approach, was arrogant, unquote. Mr. Verfaeli said he believed biotechnology was now at a watershed, and that society everywhere had changed. The shift that started 40 years ago was approaching maturity, he said. It is a movement from a trust-me society to a show-me society. We don't trust government, and thus government rulemaking and regulation is suspect. We don't trust companies or the new technologies they introduce into the marketplace. We were still in the trust-me mode when the expectation was show-me. From now on, he said, the new Monsanto would be ethical, and to prove it, it had published a 5-point pledge of new commitments, which were, he said, unprecedented in the biotechnology industry. We commit to respecting the religious, cultural, and ethical concerns of people, said Mr. Verfaeli. Monsanto will not sell grain products until they have been approved for consumption by both humans and animals, nor will Monsanto use genes taken from animal or human sources in our agricultural products intended for food or feed, or sell foods in which known allergens have been introduced. And he promised not to pursue technologies that resulted in sterile or so-called terminator seeds. The company has been criticized for imposing GM farming on poor countries. No longer. The new Monsanto will, according to its chief, bring the knowledge and advantages of all forms of agriculture to resource-poor farmers in the developing world to help improve food security and protect the environment, unquote. To those who accuse Monsanto of having consistently evaded government regulations, he promised to work legally, probably a first in corporate history. In response to critics who have alleged the company is secretive about sharing its research, he said it would now publish all scientific data and data summaries on product safety. Yesterday, the company's many critics around the world were congratulating it on its pledges, but were mostly hoping it would pledge to go away. Sweet, isn't it? Said a Friends of the Earth spokesman. Here's a company with its back to the wall and its technology going down the tube. We welcome its pledges, but it must face up to the fact that people do not want its food. We have read the commitments, said an Indian anti-GM activist who has been marching with many thousands of small farmers against Monsanto and other giant companies. They are very fine. But a tiger is not a pussycat. If it has large whiskers, it is probably still a tiger with a plan to gobble you up even faster. Monsanto, said its chief, had set up a dedicated team to facilitate its pledges and share its GM technology with public institutions, charities, and industry round the world. Yesterday, The Guardian asked the Monsanto HQ switchboard to be put through to one of the team. The call was met with an answering machine. And that was an article from the December 1st London Guardian, by John Vidal, contrite GM firm pledges to turn over a new leaf. You're listening to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests.